Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian.
In this hour, as the international community continues to try to facilitate a peace agreement among fighters in Syria, we're joined by two experts in peacemaking. But first, we rebroadcast an interview about the man some call the most polarizing and controversial Supreme Court justice in American history, Justice Antonin Scalia, who passed away on February 13th. With us is Professor Bruce Allen Murphy, the author of Scalia, A Court of One.
U.S. Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia's barbed remarks and offensive tactics have alienated even some of his conservative colleagues on the court. And many observers consider him the most polarizing justice in the history of the U.S. Supreme Court. Who is Antonin Scalia, and why did no one predict his behavior as a Supreme Court justice? With us is Bruce Allen Murphy. He is a judicial biographer and a professor of law at Lafayette College. His latest book is called Scalia, A Court of One. Welcome to the Scholar Circle, Bruce Allen Murphy. It's great to have you here.
Thank you very much, Maria. Thanks for inviting me.
Of all the justices, and I know you've been doing biographies of others as well, why Antonin Scalia specifically?
Well, it's been a journey to get to Scalia. This is my fourth judicial biography. The last one was on William O. Douglas, who was described by one of his friends, Raoul Berger, as the oddest duck who ever served on the Supreme Court. And the Douglas biography allowed me to explore the most controversial justice of that era, although he was, of course, an iconic liberal on the court. And I had been exploring through the other books on Brandeis and Frankfurter and Abe Fortas the issue of extrajudicial work by justices off the bench and the effect on the court. And when I looked for a new topic after Douglas, Scalia's name rose to the top very quickly, because he's clearly the most visible, the most controversial, and possibly the smartest and most talented intellect on this court, a man who really would be fun to spend 8 years with exploring his life, and he was indeed all of that.
It's interesting you would use the word fun, given his sort of abrasive personality.
Well, you try not to get too emotionally involved with your subjects, and you hope that you pick a topic that will keep you getting out of bed in the morning and thinking, how can I advance this work a little bit farther? And I found Scalia endlessly fascinating. I kept discovering things about him that surprised me. I kept trying to predict what he would do next, and trying to explain why my predictions weren't quite accurate. And he was an ideal subject for a biographer.
One of the things, speaking of prediction, is that hardly anybody could have predicted who he ended up becoming. And certainly in the early part of your book, you describe a guy who was affable. You describe a guy who, of course, liked to be the center of attention, but wasn't so offensive as he sort of turned out to be on the Supreme Court.
Absolutely true. When you do some of your preliminary research and biographical work, what you look for is journalistic pieces that cover the sweep of a person's life. If the individual is dead, then you start with the obituaries. If the individual is still living, you're going to start with the articles around the time when that person was put on the court. And I was puzzled almost immediately when I read a number of articles and a number of comments from people on all sides of the ideological spectrum, predicting that once Antonin Scalia was put on the Supreme Court in 1986 by Ronald Reagan, he would become the William Brennan of the conservatives. Brennan, of course, was the wingman to Earl Warren. He was the man who brought together the liberals into the activist Supreme Court, liberal court that the Warren Court became. And it was widely anticipated by everyone that Scalia, who was described as affable, gregarious, congenial, willing to compromise, willing to hear other views, these were the words that were used by these people, that he would bring the court together. And something didn't ring true, obviously, and I couldn't believe, one, that is the impression that they had in 1986, so I had to figure out from the early life, how did they get that impression? And I would have made the same prediction based on the evidence that they had in 1986, and then I had to figure out how he became who he is now.
Well, let's start to dissect that. He was an only child, and his parents were immigrants. Is that right?
It's true. And he was much more than an only child, if you can imagine that. He was the only child of his extended family's generation, which means he was also the only grandchild. So every member of his extended family, father and mother's side, doted on him, and he became used to that kind of attention, and I think it affected the way he saw the world. He was raised by an immigrant Italian father who was known as Sam Scalia. His name was actually Salvatore Eugene Scalia, a brilliant man who rose by his intellect to become a professor of Romance languages at Brooklyn College, was a very stern individual, and impressed on his son the need to be a person of considerable character. He would like to tell Antonin that muscles can be hired by the hour as an article of commerce, but character can't be sold or bought. And he was impressing upon his son the need for hard work, for scholastic effort, for academic achievement. And interestingly enough, he also had a theory called literalism. He believed that he could look at ancient Italian poets and interpret their meaning in English language by literally interpreting each of the words. So he had a theory that sort of previewed what Scalia would eventually do. And beyond that, his parents raised him in a pre-Vatican II, very traditional, very conservative Catholicism that has guided Scalia throughout his entire life.
It's a brand of Catholicism that doesn't really comport with what many Catholics hold, particularly the current Pope.
And Scalia has gotten into debates with the Catholic Church in the early 21st century over the question of the death penalty. He would like to turn the clock back in the religious world to an earlier era, and he believes that the old values are the best values. When it turns out that he doesn't agree with the current Pope or when he doesn't agree with the current Church, he argues, well, two millennia of popes agree with me, and so I choose to follow them rather than the current Church and the current Pope.
He was very conservative from very early on. He was an only child, and he didn't have to learn to play well with others. He did for a while, though.
He was capable of being very nice and playing as part of a team. He was actually a very accomplished actor when he was at Xavier High School, Jesuit school in Manhattan, and later at Georgetown University. He was a fellow that the other actors could rely on. He helped to get one of his fellow actors at Xavier through the role of playing Lady Macbeth, and the fellow was being teased, and he said Nino Scalia was able to help him through that as best he could. Scalia was a very well-liked. He was always elected to leadership positions, and in Georgetown, he was known as the actor Tony Scalia. That's the way he was billed in his in the playbills. But there was another side to him. It was true at Xavier and especially true at Georgetown. Scalia, from very early age, had an ability to see the central arguments in a debate, the jugular of the argument, if you will. And at the top levels, and Scalia was maybe the best college debater in the country of his era, the top college debaters are able to really crush their opponents, almost like an intellectual chess match, and they are not adverse to using ad hominem attack. It's expected. You're given additional points for that kind of a behavior. And that character on Georgetown's campus was known as Nino Scalia. So it was sort of a battle between these two sides, and I think that the person they were discussing in 1986 who would come to the court and bring the court together was Tony Scalia. And the person who arrived, as we'll learn down the road, is Nina Scalia.
So one became dominant later in life, whereas the other side may have been more dominant in the other parts of life.
And the one true constant in this period of his education was his pre-Vatican II Catholicism. Even though he was at a Jesuit school at Georgetown, and because of his many accomplishments, he was asked to give effectively the valedictory speech. It was called the Cohonguraten speech, named for the Cohonguraten River, or the Potomac River, the River of Swans. And he made an argument that his classmates and he were the chosen few, that if they would not lead the country in the Catholic tradition, who would? And it was their obligation to be sure that others would follow in their footsteps.
That was kind of a common theme in your book, that even in his lectures as he became a professor, he ended them frequently with this idea that you cannot separate your religion from the rest of your life.
it's a constant theme throughout his own explanation of his life. That's why I opened the book with him at President Obama's second inaugural. And Claire McCaskill, who took a picture of him in his silk hat, his skull cap, in the 2008 inaugural, it was the first tweet, I think, that she made to her followers. She was waiting to see what he would wear to the second inaugural, and he showed up in this billowy sort of black velvet cap that looked almost like a popover. And when people found out where it had come from, it turned out to be a reproduction of the cap worn by Sir Thomas More, who is one of Scalia's heroes. Scalia believes that More was the saint of law, but also he is the depiction of the kind of morality and traditional Vatican, pre-Vatican II Catholicism that Scalia favors. And so when he ended his classes at the University of Chicago Law School, he would read his class selections from A Man for All Seasons and encourage them to delve further into More's life.
Another common theme from your book is this idea that he didn't really want to engage in issues related to poor people. He thought that was a waste of his time, and he thought there were, in a quote that you have, more important things in life.
He's very much in line with meritocracy. He's not in favor of affirmative action. It's ironic for a man who was appointed to the court in the end by the president because he was an Italian-American. He de facto got an affirmative action hire for the Supreme Court. I think Scalia's belief is that you should pay attention to people who are achieving, and those people who are achieving will continue to be successful. Success will translate to financial reward. And so he's much more concerned about making it possible for those individuals to succeed rather than trying to create a country in which you do what you can to raise everybody up to a certain level so that they can achieve from that point.
Then he went to work for a big law firm doing defense work. Was it Jones Day?
Jones Day, which turned out to be pivotal in his life. He was working late at night as a law student on the Harvard Law Review, and a fellow from Jones Day in Cleveland went to the Law Review office looking for someone to hire and persuaded Scalia to at least come to Cleveland to visit for an interview. Scalia didn't get a job in Philadelphia or Boston or New York or Washington even, and he now says sometimes in his speeches, "Can you believe I went to Cleveland?" But it actually worked out for him. First of all, he got to be a generalist in the law, so he did all kinds of different cases and rose to the top very quickly. And a number of the people who were in that law firm became very well connected in the Republican Party. And so there was a fellow named Jonathan Rose who was able to get him appointments in the Nixon and the Ford administration. It was pivotal in Scalia's rise to power.
Let's go into some of this Nixon administration. First of all, rather than becoming a partner at Jones Day, he went on to teach instead. But then his colleagues went into the Nixon administration. How did he then end up going into the president's office?
Well, Scalia, I think, was a bit of a gypsy trying to figure out where he would end up. I think he played with the idea of being a private lawyer. I think he played with the idea of being an academic. Once he was at the University of Virginia, so close to be able to get on the train and go up to Washington, he was very interested in getting an appointment in Washington, somewhere where he could maybe be noticed and rise a little farther. Whether he at that point was thinking, well, gee, maybe one day I could be Solicitor General, or maybe one day I could be on the Supreme Court, I can't say. But at least he was trying to find his own place. He was exceedingly lucky in that he got his appointment to the Nixon administration just as the Nixon administration was going out of office. And Gerald Ford continued to keep him in the administration. He was in the Office of Legal Counsel. And one of his first jobs was to figure out whether or not the presidential papers were owned by Richard Nixon and should be controlled by Richard Nixon. And he wrote an opinion in favor of Nixon's ownership. It was not an opinion that was followed by Congress. It was not an opinion that was followed by the Supreme Court. But interestingly enough, the only justice who dissented in that case in the Supreme Court was William Rehnquist, who was also in the Office of Legal Counsel. So Scalia had a gift for saying the right thing at the right time and a kind of a star over his head that put him in the perfect position each time for advancement to a better position.
So he did advance in both of those situations. Before he even ended up in that Office of General Counsel, didn't he also do some work in the broadcast field?
I skipped over that, and it was very interesting because it showed me how Scalia was learning how to work in the political field. He was working in the Office of Telecommunications Corporation. His job was to try to advise his boss about the questions of PBS funding and cable channels and exactly how regulations could work in the new cable industry when you already had broadcast television. And Scalia was well aware in this process that he was in opposition to the Nixon administration. The Nixon administration just wanted to defund PBS and was very unhappy about the national news of the PBS that was very hostile to Nixon's Watergate episode. And so what Scalia tried to do was advise his boss how politically to try to get around what the Nixon administration was trying to do and move the entire structure back to the local channels. And when that didn't seem to work, he was able to find the legal justification to allow his boss to make those arguments.
So throughout his work with both presidencies, he became really well-liked by two key people. One is Donald Rumsfeld, one is Dick Cheney.
You could count on Antonin Scalia to do what the Ford administration and what Gerald Ford needed to have done. And what I found especially interesting, he didn't do a lot of work directly with Cheney and Rumsfeld, but they were working on the same issues in different parts of the administration. Here were three men, one much younger than the other two, who had worked their entire professional careers to get to the White House, to work with the president, and they were in a sinking administration, not through their own fault, not even through Gerald Ford's fault. This was a presidency as an institution that was greatly diminished by the Watergate episode. And so daily they were dealing with leaks to the press, and they were dealing with investigations by Congress. And I think it drove them all a little bit crazy that they had finally risen to this level of power, and they had no power. I think you find the roots there, certainly, of Scalia's affection for and determination to continue a much more powerful presidential office.
So you see this relationship, too, that develops between Donald Rumsfeld, Dick Cheney, and Antonin Scalia from back in those days in a particular level of trust.
True, and it will go on for decades to come, and many years down the road in 2004 when Scalia goes duck hunting with Vice President Cheney at a time when the Vice President had a case before the Supreme Court dealing with his Energy Commission in the White House, Scalia is rather incredulous that people think that he should recuse himself, step down from that case, because he says this is a friendship that I've had for so long, and so many other justices have had friendships with presidents. True enough, but they haven't had friendships with people who had cases then before the court.
You must wonder if one can be truly neutral in such cases.
Well, I don't think there was any doubt how he would come out in that case, but at least you have to have the appearance of propriety. And under that federal recusal rule that deals with whether or not a judge or a justice should step down, the standard is, would a reasonable person believe that you had an appearance of impropriety? And Scalia's argument in a 21-page memo was, if you think that I am improper here, you can't be reasonable, because no reasonable person that I know would think that this is an improper relationship.
Well, let me just remind listeners that we're speaking with Bruce Allen Murphy, and we're talking about Scalia. That's the name of the book, Scalia, A Court of One, which is a rich biography about Antonin Scalia. While he was in the Nixon and Ford administration, a big part of his mission was derailing the Freedom of Information Act.
Yes, and he had a real difficulty with all of the leaks and all of the information that was going to the press from the Ford administration. And I think he developed an antipathy to the notion of private secret information, administrative information in Washington, eventually being available to the public through these outlets. So he was always trying to find a way to undermine the Freedom of Information Act and make it impossible for anyone to get that kind of information. One of the unique things that he came up with was there were exemptions and ways that you could get around the administration saying, we're not going to make this information available to you, even though you followed congressional law. And one of the exemptions was if the White House said this is part of their working papers, then they need to keep that secret, sort of an executive privilege kind of situation. So Scalia came up with the idea of putting remote White House operations in all of the different agencies where people would be trying to get information, so that wherever you went for that information, you could say, oh, there's a White House operative there. I'm sorry, that information is in the exemption and you can't get it. You see this basic distrust of the press throughout Scalia's career. It's a curious relationship. He needs the press to be able to have them report on his speeches and report on his statements so that he can get the kind of attention that he's looking for. But he also keeps the press at arm's length and at times will exclude them from his activities because he can't control what they're going to say or do.
And it didn't seem like it was just the press, but any public information.
Yeah, he's not a fan of any public information, any secret information, any classified information getting out to the general public. He's very skeptical of the sort of democratic process by which people get transparency in their government so that they can vote the kinds of governors that they're seeking to get. He would much rather keep that information secret.
You wrote about how one of the people he fought was Ralph Nader at the time, and then he organized the CIA to help derail any advances with the Freedom of Information Act. Tell us what happened in these.
Well, he did. What Ralph Nader was trying to do was get information on the Ford pardon of Richard Nixon. He wanted to know what kind of deal, if any, was made before Nixon left the White House. And what Scalia was doing there was opposing Ralph Nader, but also he was very skilled because of his earlier positions in the Nixon and Ford administration at knowing which people to call and which agencies to get the result that he wanted. And so he was able to give individuals in various agencies, defense agencies and the CIA, the kind of information that they needed to keep their documents secret in spite of the Freedom of Information Act, and also to organize amongst themselves and try to lobby the White House to get Gerald Ford to not sign off on the amendment that would change the Freedom of Information Act and open things up further.
Did you ever get a sense of what he was really afraid of in this process? Like, why didn't he believe in open government?
You know, I got the sense that he knew what his role was. I think the process that he was learning is the process that you see now on the court. You give me an issue, I will find the central part of that issue. I will figure out where I want to go, and then I will figure out what information I need to marshal in order to justify the result that I've already decided on. And that seemed to be what he was doing in all of these positions. He was learning bits and pieces of how to use the bureaucracy, how to use legal argumentation, how to use political argumentation, how to balance out all of the interests so that he could lead the president and the administration where they wanted to go. He was there to serve the president, Gerald Ford. Gerald Ford was in trouble. He was having trouble dealing with the press and Congress, and he was having trouble facing an election in 1976. His popularity continued to drop despite everything that he did because of what he had inherited from Richard Nixon. So I think Scalia is a very loyal individual, stayed until the very end of the Ford administration, even though it might have made it difficult for him to land in a different job. And in the process of trying to bolster the president, he learned how to be the Antonin Scalia we see now on the court.
President Carter comes into office. What does Antonin Scalia decide to do?
Well, very interesting, because what he decides to do is go out to Chicago. Most people, I think, would have stayed in Washington, and he flirted with that idea at Georgetown and being the law school. But he ended up going out to Chicago because he wanted to. He thought his money would stretch farther. He had a big family. They ended up living in an old fraternity house, and it would have given him a chance to figure out what to do next. So he had a foot in both worlds. He was teaching in Chicago, and he was also maintaining some of his connections in Washington. And as it turned out, it was another lucky turn in his life, because there were students out there who were beginning to put together what has become the Federalist Society. And they were working with a student at Yale where Robert Bork was teaching. And so you see sort of two camps that begin to arise, the Scalia camp among the conservatives and the Federalist Society, and then the Bork camp among the conservatives and the Federalist Society in Yale. And I think what happens is the beginnings of a sort of almost wariness and awareness that the next step in my career is going to have to be past Robert Bork, because Bork is better known at that point. He's been the Solicitor General. He was the man who fired Archibald Cox. He was the man who was mentioned for the seat that eventually went to John Paul Stevens. He's in the driver's seat for what will be a Supreme Court seat down the road. You want to get that seat, you've got to get past Robert Bork. And that leads us to his time on the Court of Appeals, where he gets to go side by side with Robert Bork.
He gets appointed to the appellate court, and he's still being an affable guy. He's starting to carve out his judicial theory here. We're starting to see it, but he worked well with the other side.
Generally, he did. He was appointed to the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia, which is a real proving ground for a Supreme Court appointment. It deals with a lot of administrative law appointments and a lot of law positions. And he was on a court in which the most visible judge in the federal system, Robert Bork, had been sitting for some time. He was more senior. He had been mentioned for the Supreme Court back in 1974. For Scalia, this became something of a proving ground. He did get along generally with the other members of that court. He did have his moments. He used to write and argue in cases so vehemently when he really truly believed in those issues that some of his work was called the Nino Path. What he was able to do was work within that system and position himself well against Robert Bork. All in all, this became sort of an intellectual judicial pose down for Scalia, using the term of bodybuilding. He was able to show the administration that he was younger, that he was in better health, and that he was a little better conservative and, they thought, more affable. He was able to get along with the other judges.
Bruce Allen Murphy, thank you so much for being with us this week.
My pleasure, Maria. I look forward to next week's conversation.
That is the first part of a two-part interview that we are doing with Bruce Allen Murphy about his book, Scalia, A Court of One. We will continue the conversation next week. When we come back, the real-life effective strategies for lasting peace building. Stay tuned. Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. As the international community continues to try to facilitate a peace agreement among the fighters in Syria, we're joined by two experts on peacemaking. Peter Wallenstein is Senior Professor of Peace and Conflict Research at Uppsala University in Sweden and Professor of Peace Studies at the University of Notre Dame. He's the author of Quality Peace, Peacebuilding, Victory, and World Order. Irvin Staub is with us. He is Emeritus Professor at University of Massachusetts. He's the author of Overcoming Evil, Genocide, Violent Conflict, and Terrorism, and the latest book, The Roots of Goodness and Resistance to Evil, Inclusive, Caring, Moral Courage, Altruism Born of Suffering, Active Bystandership, and Heroism. Welcome to the Scholar's Circle, Peter Wallenstein and Irvin Staub. It's great to talk with you both again here.
It's nice to be here again.
Very happy to be on your program.
And Peter Wallenstein, I thought what we should do is start with your most recent book and the research that we discussed last time. Essentially, the fact that peace agreements are increasing in number, I think the numbers you had in the book were that we had 178 peace agreements in the last 20 years, whereas the 20 years before there were only about 28. How do we explain this? What is happening? And in terms of the long arc of history, what is this telling us about us as a humanity?
I think this is basically good news. In 2014, although that was a very bad year, we still saw a number of peace agreements, and some of them are now hopefully being implemented, like the ones in Mindanao, and the work is going on in Colombia. So this is good news. And I relate it very much to the end of the Cold War. During the Cold War, conflicts were considered strategic, and the only thing that mattered was victory, not really long-term settlement. After the Cold War, there has been much more an understanding of conflicts as humanitarian disasters and that they should not be allowed to happen. And at most times, you would try to find solutions that incorporate the conflicting sides' views. And I think that is basically what has happened. And the record is not bad. It's not a tremendous success, but it is much better, and particularly much better than the victories that we have seen in the last 25 years.
So in essence, one of the things that's changed is people's beliefs, is what it seems.
Yes, and the perspective in which one is looking at conflict, not necessarily as strategic matters, but as I said, the disasters. So there is an attitude difference there, which I think is very important. We do not accept any longer, we in the world, human beings, that a lot of people are being killed in wars. We want them to be low-level violence, and we want them to be solved. And that is why people today are very frustrated and sometimes disillusioned because of the inability to stop the war in Syria, for instance.
Well, Irvin Staub, from a psychological standpoint, what would you say about this?
First of all, I would just, point to the fact that there are some very significant wars that have been taking place in the last decade or two. For example, in Sri Lanka, there was this tremendous violence between the Tamil rebels and the government. And, of course, there is Syria and Iran, and there is the Ukraine and a good number of other places. And what Peter described is very encouraging. There is also the question of what is required after peace. First of all, what is required for people to move to peace agreements, and what is required then for peace agreements to hold? Some time ago, a part of the wisdom about group relations was that in order for peace agreements to hold, there have to be reconciliation processes between groups. And without that, there is a greater chance for violence to resume. Now, what do reconciliation processes mean? And some of these processes are same as preventing violence in the first place. A really core issue in violence, leading to violence, is seeing the other party as hostile, seeing it in a very negative light, seeing it as dangerous to oneself, and the feeling that one has to do something about that. Another really important issue often is in group relations that either party creates what may be called, what I have called, a destructive ideology, a belief that in order to elevate one's own group and improve the circumstances of one's group, one has to deal with this other party that somehow stands in the way. This is certainly the case, has been the case in genocidal violence, but you can also see this in group relations when the groups are nations. You look at instances and cases, in Rwanda, where I have worked for many years, are the Hutus and Tutsis each. The Hutus that were perpetrators of the genocide felt that in order to ensure their own safety, their own future, good things for the group, they have to really neutralize and deal with the Tutsis, who presented in their eyes a constant danger that they want to regain supremacy, and they will diminish them and hold them in servitude. You know, if you look at the Israeli-Palestinian relations, vision of a greater Israel is one of these destructive ideologies, enhancing one's own group, recreating a future great, a past greatness, but the other group stands in the way. And if you look at the Palestinians, you know, the same thing. The inability, unwillingness to accept that that territory can be shared between Palestinians and Israelis. So overcoming negative views of the other, overcoming destructive ideologies. There are a whole bunch of other things, but I'm going to just mention one other before, you know, you might want to ask us other questions. And there is one of the things about violence is hostility, negativity, and violence, that it evolves progressively. Very often there are small things that happen and they intensify and a group does more and then they justify what they do. And so understanding the influences that lead to violence can be extremely important, because in many societies, people generally tend to follow what the authorities and the experts tell them. They don't make their own judgments. Often they don't have the opportunity because the media in their society doesn't provide sufficient information, correct, truthful information. So understanding what are some of the things that lead to violence, such as these negative views of the others, scapegoating others, destructive ideologies, overly strong respect for authority, and then the passivity of people, of bystanders who could take some kind of action in this process, are very important and makes it more likely that people will take action.
Peter Wallenstein, let's bring you in.
Yes, the first part of what Irving says is I agree completely with. And that is, what is the basics of conflicts? And I'm, of course, concerned with the wars, but there are many of the same developments when you look at genocide. And for me, the basic finding, I think, when I look at the literature on internal wars, is the what I call the need for a respect for human dignity, that we have to respect human variation, that people can be of different sorts, and there is nobody who can say, I am better than you, and use that as a basis. And for me, then, the role of democracy becomes very important. The well-functioning democracy can actually take care of a number of these conflicts. And I also find the more recent results on gender equality extremely interesting, that the more gender equality, the less likely there is of civil wars or violations of human rights. And I take that as an indicator of increased tolerance, and that tolerance is really the key for finding solutions that are more lasting and have more of a quality for the people involved.
We clearly think in similar ways. You know, when I talk about devaluation, I mean the same thing that you mean, respecting the other, respecting human dignity, and also pluralism. The ability of different groups to have a voice and participate in the societal processes is one of the things that makes such evolution less likely. You know, very frequently when a group in a society or hostility towards an outside group emerges and leaders advocate it, many people in the society salute and they go along. And to have groups that can speak in their own behalf and say, no, this is not how we should be seen, and this is not right the way we are treated, and have other voices in the society also that can speak out about the evolution of negativity and hostility towards another society, very important. But, you know, this understanding of influences, which is something that has been very much our work in Rwanda, in workshops, in radio programs, understanding the history. I mean, if you think about Iran and the United States, if people in the United States really understood how the hostility by Iran towards the United States has developed, And Iran behaves in very problematic ways. It does support terrorism and it does do other things. But if you think about the history, that there was a democratically elected leader of the country and the CIA was involved in overthrowing it and putting the Shah, who created a very repressive dictatorship. And then during the war between Iraq and Iran, we supported Iraq in spite of the fact that Iraq used chemical weapons, and on, that can allow people to see more the humanity of these others, understand why their behavior may be as it is, rather than just simply seeing them as bad people, aggressors whom we must deal with.
Some of the things that we've all been talking about here, there's so many questions that come up from it. And Peter, I'm going to bring you in just a second to respond. One is the role of people to harm a society, like in the case you've been talking about, Ervin Staub, with the U.S. having a role in harming Iranians. I wonder often if the role of an apology, is there place for the U.S. to apologize? And would that make a difference in something like, say, Iran-U.S. relations? Ervin, could you respond to that first and then Peter?
This is one of the tragedies of group relations. People who harm others, individuals too, but the groups resist so intensely to acknowledge the harm that they have done, express regret and apologize. Overcoming that is very important, because I do think that humbly expressing regret and saying, yes, we have done that, and even expressing willingness and readiness and taking action to in some ways balance the harm that one has done. You know, what has the United States done? Of course, no apology, but what has the United States done to benefit Iran in sort of making up for it? What has Israel actually done to benefit Palestinians? Of course, Palestinians also have done a lot of harm to Israel, but Israel is the greater power, and it is in a position to express regret for some of its actions and try actions that would actually benefit Palestinians. Unfortunately, you are absolutely right. If countries could do this genuinely, heartfelt, it could make a real difference.
Peter Wallenstein.
Yes, I think Ervin is right that the apology would need to be credible. And it is probably made credible by a lot of actions that are actually costing to the one making the apology. So it's not a cheap apology. It's easy for a politician to say, yes, we apologize, and then go on and think that that is correct or enough. But it has to be something that is really costly and difficult to give. And once you give it, it means more. And I think one of the most important such apologies is when the German Chancellor Brandt was kneeling in front of the Jewish memorial in Warsaw. And that was costly for him politically in Germany. Lots of people resisted it, but he still did it. And in the end, it actually, you know, becomes a strength of the German society to having done this. And it is, of course, coupled also to reparations and an attitude to Israel that is also long-lasting. So it's not so easy to make an apology. And the apology has to be credible. And that has been the main discussion, for instance, between Japan, Korea, and China, whether the Japanese apology is really as deep as it is, and as there constantly are actions saying something else, which makes people not believe that it is genuine and sincere.
Peter Wallenstein, I had interrupted you earlier, and I think you were on a train of thought, and I just wanted to give you a chance to say whatever that was.
No problem. I was thinking of some of the things that Ervin said very correctly, which had to do with the feeling of insecurity and so on. I do remember a lot of situations in Yugoslavia where people would say, well, in our village, in our town, we all know each other and we will keep together. And then some outsiders come in one night and kill some people from one of the communities, and that community immediately starts to form itself in a defensive position, arming itself, which makes all the other communities worried. So sometimes you can willfully institute insecurity in societies in order to destroy these kind of human fabrics. That is an important challenge, that those in favor of the things that we say, human dignity, respect for human variety, etc., actually also are able to protect that when things become serious.
I am sorry, but I agree with everything that Peter is saying. You know, apparently we are not going to fight.
This is not a bad thing. This is actually okay.
It's not a bad thing.
Agreement is not a bad thing. Panels are not always about disagreement.
Exactly.
But that's one thing right. I did want to bring up that Peter mentioned earlier, there's some scholarship that challenges the idea that democracy is the answer. I'm thinking of Mann's book, I think it was called The Dark Side of Democracy. And I recall in my studies in Rwanda, and so Irvin, maybe this is something that you can respond to, one of the arguments for annihilating Tutsi people was to build a majoritarian democracy. So is democracy necessarily the answer, or can it also just be a tool of oppressors? Irvin Staub, what do you think?
Well, certainly the majority has the potential in a democracy to oppress the minority. So democracy can vary in its nature, in its characteristics. I mean, you could say that in the United States now, very wealthy people have so much influence in the political process through the money they contribute, through the way they influence legislators, and so on, that the poorer segments of the population are in a way oppressed. You could argue that in the United States, for some time now, the way the justice system has been used and the prisons have been used has become a form of oppression of African Americans, of minorities, of keeping them in place in their repressed situation. So, yes, democracy is not perfect. And also, some democracies are what I talk about, mature democracies. Of course, the United States has all these problems that I just described, and it's a very mature democracy. The Weimar Republic was not a mature democracy, and it was more vulnerable. But every democracy is, to some degree, has the potential of creating categories of people and potentially have some more power and others have difficulties. So also people have done research to say that democracies, good developed democracies, mature democracies, as I call them, don't have genocides. Well, this is true generally, but mature democracies like England and the United States can do things in other countries that contribute to great violence. So, for example, when there were something like 1.5 million people killed in Indonesia several decades ago, England supported some of that, and I think the United States was to some degree also involved, not in the killing, not in any direct way, but in supporting the anti-communist claims, not realities, but claims in the name of which that violence took place. Peter might know more about that particular situation than I do. At any rate, I agree with you that one has to ask about democracies also. Is this functioning well? Are the rights of minorities represented? Are people protected, whatever groups they belong to? Is there a justice system, and so on?
Peter Wallenstein.
I think we should be clear about that the democracy does have to have certain additional qualities to really function, because you can see some very difficult issues. The one in Northern Ireland has taken place in a parliamentarian democracy, one of the strongest, or India has a lot of local conflicts. And you mentioned before, Irvin, Sri Lanka, which also was a functioning democracy, but it did not have that respect for minorities or wasn't willing to incorporate that in a simple way into the way democracy works. So I would say democracy requires also a respect for minority rights and has to have an attitude of general tolerance. And you give examples with the United States. I'm in a country who is a member of the European Union. And for us, what is now happening in Poland and Hungary is really worrying. Although these are democratically elected regimes, they do have a much more authoritarian understanding of what they could do in trying to control mass media, public television, etc., etc. And all that is really worrying. So it is not sufficient with democracy. It's a good beginning, but it needs to be a certain quality to that democracy.
Just a reminder that you're listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about the real-life effective strategies for lasting peace building.
One other thing that you've both mentioned early on is this destructive ideology, particularly how that fueled the Cold War and the destructiveness of that. And today, I think what we're seeing in most of our conflicts, or at least in a good part of them, is a destructive ideology that is religiously based. Irvin, you mentioned the Greater Israel, but there's also the jihadi idea that they have to kill the non-believers, or infidel is the one that had been used historically. But how does a peacemaker, a strategic peace builder, deal with things such as these extraordinarily destructive ideologies?
Well, one thing that is rather hopeless is to try to convert people who are true advocates of this extreme ideology. What you have to go to is people in the middle, people who either hold a different view or people who are somewhere in the middle. They are not, maybe even support the group that advocates that ideology, but are not really committed to it. And in this case, I believe that this includes the large majority of Muslims. But it is complicated. Why is it complicated? First of all, I mean, there are several things here. One of them is that Saudi Arabia continues to teach, and many places around the Islamic world, they continue to teach in schools that were established with money from Saudi Arabia, kids, this extreme version of Islam, which basically makes all infidels seen in a very negative light, is hostile to anything that is not Islam. Well, as long as this continues and this fed into people's thinking and minds, it is difficult to counteract it. Now, how do you counteract some of these processes? It's really step by step, working with groups of people who are engaged in a different ways. There is, for example, people have advocated a European Islam, which is much more accepting and positive in nature, and trying to expand that and export that into other parts of the world. You know, Islam is capable of more acceptance. You know, people have shown how Muslims tend to acculturate in varied societies and can do quite well there, including the United States, including Australia. With regard to Saudi Arabia, I mean, one of the amazing things about it is that the United States and the Saudis are great allies. And the United States has never spoken out, as far as anybody knows, against these teachings that Saudi Arabia spreads. So it's a multifaceted process where one has to support people within Islam who are trying to propagate a different kind of thinking. And one also has to engage in political processes in relation to nations that are advocating these extreme forms of Islam. And there are many others, for sure.
Peter Wallenstein, what would you say?
Yeah, I would say three key words here. One would be containment, try to contain these kind of groups. And the second is marginalize, try to make them on the sides of the mainstream. And the third thing is really encourage those that really represent the broader groupings. And so if you go to Syria or Iraq, for instance, where IS is a Sunni movement and benefits from discrimination and so on by the Shiites against the Sunnis early on in Iraq. And of course, you have a similar situation in Syria, where the big majority in Syria is basically Sunni. But the IS starts to portray itself as the only one who can defend the Sunnis. But I think the important thing here is to then support in various ways other Sunnis that can represent that kind of a message. That would mean that they would be more central and gradually be able to marginalize the others. But it has to be something within the Islamic context. I don't think we can sort of expect a secular framework, but we can expect a framework which is much more within an Islamic context, and in that sense be able to help communicate and hopefully remove the society from these extreme groups. Unfortunately, you will see that those possible actors are also suppressed by others. The Saudis, as Ervin mentioned, Egypt also represses more liberal or more mainstream, more representative groups within the Islamic community. So the alternatives here are not necessarily attractive. I find the development in Tunisia among the more interesting, and the Nobel Peace Prize in 2015 was given to a coalition that really tried to do exactly what I said, to really build on the center of the society, the labor movements, the human rights movements, and the employers' association to develop something which avoids falling into the extremes of either an authoritarianism or jihadism.
Peter Wallenstein and Ervin Staub, it's always a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you for sharing your thoughts and wisdom and research with us here on the Scholar Circle.
Thank you, Maria. Yeah, thanks a lot.
That is the first part of a two-part interview. We will continue the conversation next week. Peter Wallenstein is Senior Professor of Peace and Conflict Research at Uppsala University in Sweden and Professor of Peace Studies at the University of Notre Dame. He's the author of Quality Peace, Peacebuilding, Victory, and World Order. Ervin Staub is Emeritus Professor at University of Massachusetts. He's the author of Overcoming Evil, Genocide, Violent Conflict, and Terrorism, and the latest book, The Roots of Goodness and Resistance to Evil, Inclusive, Caring, Moral Courage, Altruism Born of Suffering, Active Bystandership, and Heroism.
And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible.
To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening.
If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at @Armudian, and we'll see you next week. ¶¶